Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 5th of February. The US shoots down a Chinese balloon off the coast of South Carolina, accusing China of an unacceptable violation of sovereignty. Thousands of Israelis in Tel Aviv demonstrate against plans by the Netanyahu government to limit the power of judges. And Pakistan blocks access to the Wikipedia website. Also in the podcast, why the war in Ukraine has forced an Austrian band to split up. And
it was necessary to do a new translation because the old ones are either too bland or there are too many mistakes in them.
The English National Opera prepares to stage a newly translated version of Wagner's The Rheingold. For the past few days, the US military has been tracking a suspected Chinese spy balloon as it travelled east across America. On Wednesday, it was spotted over the state of Montana, home to one of America's three nuclear missile sites. A plan to shoot it down was rejected because of the danger from falling debris on the ground. But on Saturday afternoon, as it left the coast of South Carolina and moved out over the Atlantic, it was shot down. President Biden said he made the decision several days ago.
On Wednesday, when I was briefed on the balloon, I ordered the Pentagon to shoot it down as soon as possible, without doing damage to anyone on the ground. They decided that the best time to do that was as it got over water within a 12-mile limit. It successfully took it down, and I want to compliment our aviators who did it.
President Biden. Not long before recording this podcast, David Willis in Washington told my colleague Lise Doucette more about how the balloon had been brought down.
Well, the Pentagon said the balloon was brought down about 6 miles off the Carolinas coast by a single missile fired from a U.S. fighter jet from Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. And that same official also said that over the course of the last few years, Chinese balloons have been spotted across five continents, including in East Asia, South Asia and Europe. And that official said that its presence in the United States, of course it drifted all the way across the US from Alaska, represented an unacceptable violation of US sovereignty.
We understand that the debris was spread over about 7 miles. Is it clear what the next priority in this effort is going to be?
That's a good question. The challenge now for US Navy ships in the area will be to retrieve the equipment on board that downed balloon before, of course, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. If US officials are able to retrieve the data collected and successfully decode it, they should then be able to establish for certain what this balloon's purpose actually was. Was it gathering weather data, as China insists it was? Or was it on a spying mission, as Pentagon officials contend? This is quite a challenge, though, logistically at least, because the Atlantic Ocean sinks to about 6,500 feet in depth, fairly shortly off the coastline. So in order to get the most out of this, they really have to collect all of that machinery, all of that data to be able to subject it to analysis.
And it's interesting because President Biden said he told the U.S. military to shoot it down as soon as possible. That's from Wednesday to Saturday, which underlines just how much planning had to go into this.
Absolutely. And the Pentagon official who briefed the media today confirming that that was the case, that President Biden asked the military to present options on Wednesday, said that it had been felt that there was undue risk to U.S. civilians under the balloon's path. And it wasn't actually safe to conduct this sort of operation because of the risk of debris harming civilians until the balloon was at sea and in U.S. territorial airspace as well.
David Willis in Washington talking to Lise Doucette. Thousands of Israelis in Tel Aviv have been taking part in another protest against the government of Benjamin Netanyahu and its plans to reduce the powers of the judiciary. Mr. Netanyahu and his ultra-nationalist coalition partners want to give the government more power over appointing judges and limit judges' ability to block legislation. These protesters said the proposed changes were solely in the interests of the Prime Minister.
I'm here for an important protest against a corrupted government and a corrupted Prime Minister. They want to tear up the judiciary system of Israel. They want to tear up Israeli democracy. And we are here every week in every weather to fight against it and to fight for Israeli democracy.
I'm here tonight protesting against the transition of Israel from a democracy to an autocracy in order to serve one person's agenda. The Prime Minister is focusing on dragging all of Israel into some sort of totalitarian autocracy, all in his service. It's a disgrace. It shall not stand.
More details about the demonstrations from Sebastian Usher.
Last Saturday, the weekly rally against Benjamin Netanyahu and his coalition that's reliant on small ultranationalist and religious parties was subdued after the attack by a Palestinian gunman in Jerusalem that killed seven people the previous evening. But the protest has regained momentum with a big turnout. Mr. Netanyahu's predecessor as Prime Minister, Yair Lapid, has posted a video of himself among the protesters saying that they'd come to save Israel. Over the past week, the showdown over the government's radical plan for judicial reform has only intensified, with the Attorney General saying that it could damage the country's core democratic values.
Sebastian Usher. Well, January was one of the deadliest months in years for Israelis and Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. More than 30 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces, including 10 in a raid on Jenin refugee camp. A day later, seven Israelis were killed during the Jewish Sabbath when a Palestinian gunman opened fire outside a synagogue in a settlement. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell has been back to the scene of the shooting and to Jenin to ask Israelis and Palestinians what happens next.
I'm outside the synagogue where the shooting happened just 1 week ago. There is a floral wreath here, a sign up that has all the names of those who were killed, and another big banner that says, "The blood of our children isn't cheap," in Hebrew. Why did you want to come so much today?
To show the Arabs that we're one big nation and no one can stop us and we're unstoppable and God is with us.
And we love our country, we love Israel and our land.
Amon imcha.
Were the chosen people?
Young women and girls who came to show their support stand at the curbside waving Israeli flags. After the deadly shooting, Israel's new government, the country's most right-wing ever, announced tough measures to punish Palestinian attackers' families, as well as plans to reinforce settlements. They're seen as illegal under international law, but Israel disagrees. This woman wants politicians to act decisively.
Make sure our homes are safe, make sure our streets are safe, our kids could walk safely. We're not going to sit down for terror. It should not exist anywhere in the world, especially not in a neighborhood as quiet as this.
But driving around Palestinian neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, there's increasing disquiet. Both the synagogue attacker and a 13-year-old, who later shot and wounded two Israelis, were close to Palestinian teenagers shot dead in recent confrontations with Israeli forces. Tensions are spiralling here and across the West Bank. Next, I head north on a two-hour journey to Jenin with its crowded urban refugee camp and meet Ali, who says he lives in fear and uncertainty.
When I leave the house to go to work, I'm not sure I will come back home to my kids. I always call my brothers and sisters, my friend and my father. Why? Because I might lose them any minute. I check that they are still alive.
We're among the wreckage of cars smashed up in the latest Israeli raid, which killed 10 people, two of them civilians. Israeli forces say they were targeting an Islamic Jihad cell plotting major attacks when they came under fire from armed fighters in the camp. Jenin's seen repeated Israeli incursions since a series of deadly attacks by Palestinians on Israelis early last year. Several attackers were from this area. Now some here are calling for a new uprising. I'm not the only one ready. We're all ready for a third intifada, says Salim. The boys of the camp sing that it's the address of heroes. There's bravado here. but also a growing sense of despair because of what's seen as the lack of any meaningful plan for lasting peace.
A report by Yoland Nell. Blasphemy is a hugely sensitive issue in Pakistan, particularly with regards to comments about Islam. Now, the authorities there have blocked the Wikipedia website, saying it contained blasphemous content. The crowdsourced online encyclopedia was given a 48-hour deadline to remove the material, but the authorities say it failed to comply. So what exactly did officials object to? A question I put to our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
The Pakistani Telecommunication Authority, they gave a warning to the Wikipedia managers a couple of days ago saying that there was blasphemous content, sacrilegious, and they should be removed. Otherwise, we would have to issue special orders to block the web pages of Wikipedia. And it did not happen. And today they announced that they are going to block it because of these alleged blasphemous comments. But they did not specify what are those. And usually, you know, blasphemous comments refer to anything against religion, but in this case, the regulator did not specify. In its own response, the Wikimedia Foundation, the US-based foundation, said this particular project involves thousands of volunteer writers and they publish their own material and it is a community-based project. And by blocking this, they are denying access of, you know, free information to millions of people. And that has been the response from the Wikimedia Foundation.
And why is the Pakistani government targeting Wikipedia? I'd have thought that social media sites would have much more controversial information.
What the Pakistan authorities have done over the years is that they were able to reach some sort of understanding or working relations with the various social media companies. For example, YouTube. It was banned for nearly 4 years, and then there were some country-specific pages that allowed the authorities to block certain content, which they thought, you know, could incite violence. Whereas in Wikipedia's case, the very nature of the page itself is like anyone can log in and then make their own comments, and that is why there are some comments or history which the authorities thought, you know, they should be re-returned or they should be properly sourced. Otherwise, it can create some trouble.
And what's been the reaction to this move?
There have been very strong reaction among the digital rights activists and also many journalists. According to the Wikimedia Foundation, about 50 million users, they regularly use Wikipedia pages. People always go to find information and they use that for the writing or for understanding. So you're blocking the whole thing is not going to help the cause. It is very regressive. It is discriminatory and also unconstitutional, this kind of a blanket ban.
Anbarasan Etirajan, our South Asia regional editor. The fallout from the Russian invasion of Ukraine has been devastating for the Ukrainian people and indeed many Russians. It's also disrupted the global economy through high energy prices and food shortages. But there's also been an unexpected impact in Austria. There, a Russian-themed band that's built up a cult international following over the past 18 years says it's been forced to split up. Ruskaya says the conflict in Ukraine made it impossible to continue satirizing the Soviet Union. Danny Eberhard has the story.
Ruskaya, not a band for the faint-hearted. The gravelly vocals of Russian-born Georgi Makazaria. Surrounded by a swirling, fiery mix of horns, violin, drums, and the bass of Ukrainian-born Dmitry Nila. Dressed in trademark red and black outfits, they built a reputation for wild live performances. Russian turbo polka metal, ska punk, call it what you like. It was pure party music. But the party, it seems, is over. Ruskaya have been stridently anti-war, but in a Facebook post, they said they'd been subjected to daily abuse online, depicting them as Russian terrorists, even if they say they're the exact opposite. It's ironic for a multicultural, multinational band which stresses it stands for peace, diversity and cohesion. Ruskaya fears for the safety of their crew while on tour, and the band says what was still funny musical satire before Russia's invasion of Ukraine now seems only tragic, with a very bitter aftertaste. Even if the war was to stop, they add, the Soviet image will be damaged and taboo forever. So, they said, they felt compelled to take the incredibly sad decision to call it a day, though they're signing off with a new album. Perhaps it's too early to proclaim that Russian turbo polka punk is dead just yet.
Danny Eberhardt. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
It does concern me. There are thousands of satellites up in this particular orbit that we call low Earth orbit.
Growing worries about the overcrowded night sky. No more war and no more bloodshed. That was the impassioned plea by Pope Francis as he called for an end to tribal and ethnic violence in South Sudan on the second day of his visit to the world's newest nation. The Pope is visiting along with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the moderator of the Church of Scotland. Our religion editor, Aline McBall, reports from the capital, Juba.
Fratelli, sorelle, sosteniamoci in questo.
Today in South Sudan, a rare religious event, a cross-denominational prayer service led jointly by the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the moderator of the Church of Scotland, and it was attended by thousands. It's all part of a mission to try to bring lasting peace to a country that's seen violence and civil war since 2013, just 2 years after it gained independence. Despite a 2018 peace deal, attacks driven by ethnic tensions have continued. It's thought more than 400,000 people have died as a result. Even Pope Francis kissing the feet of South Sudan's rival tribal leaders at the Vatican 4 years ago couldn't deliver peace. So what, I asked Archbishop Justin Welby, would make him feel this trip had worked?
Success in this trip must be measured by the degree to which it gives hope to the people of South Sudan and impetus to the rulers of South Sudan to make the necessary sacrifices to give this country a future and a hope.
As unprecedented as this trip has been, and as much joy as it's brought to some here, there's also scepticism among weary South Sudanese that it'll result in real progress.
Aline McBall in South Sudan. This week, the Canadian province of British Columbia decriminalised the possession of small amounts of hard drugs, including fentanyl and heroin. It's part of a 3-year pilot aimed at combating the opioid crisis. Since Canada declared a public health emergency in 2016, there have been 10,000 drug-related deaths. Dr. Patricia Daly is the Chief Medical Officer and Vice President of Vancouver Coastal Health. She spoke to Audrey Brown.
Decriminalization is not legalization of these substances. They remain illegal in Canada under our federal drug laws, but it allows people to possess a small quantity of substances for personal use, heroin, fentanyl. It also includes cocaine, including crack cocaine, methamphetamines like crystal meth, ecstasy. The threshold is 2.5 grams in total, which if you took a picture of 2.5 grams of these substances would be about the size of a Canadian quarter or a UK pound. A UK pound coin weighs about over 8 grams. So 2.5 grams is a small amount. If police encounter someone with 2.5 grams or less of substances, they are not subject to arrest and they will not confiscate those drugs. Instead, they can give them an information card that can link them to health and social services. If they have above that amount, they have discretion. If they believe the drugs are for personal use, they also may not be subject to arrest. But trafficking of these drugs remains illegal and the drugs themselves are illegal. And this is only in the province of British Columbia. And this is where the public health emergency is declared. And you mentioned the 10,000 deaths, over 10,000 deaths since 2016. It's only in the province of British Columbia, which is a population of about 5.3 million. So we've certainly seen a rise in overdose deaths across the country, but it's most intense here in this province.
Right. And why is that? And why actually is the opioid crisis so intense?
Well, it's complex. Vancouver is a port of entry for drugs. The historical pattern of illegal drugs into Vancouver actually came from China. That was disrupted during the pandemic. And actually, our drug supply, which has now changed, is even more toxic than it was before. What we found is that, especially because of prohibition, while we had a history of relatively stable, I would say, heroin users in the province of British Columbia, as we saw the drug supply change and heroin get replaced with fentanyl, which is much more potent, more toxic, more deadly, we started to see a rise in deaths occurring. And that drive to switch to fentanyl is probably because it was easier to transport smaller, more potent quantities of fentanyl into the country. And so in 2016, we declared a public health emergency. But despite significant investments by our governments, harm reduction services, increased treatment services, the death rate increased. We saw a little dip in 2019, but during the pandemic, in part because of our pandemic response, we saw a tremendous rise in deaths. And we haven't really addressed the underlying cause, which is the toxic illegal drug supply. That's really the problem here.
Dr. Patricia Daly talking to Audrey Brown. Residents in the Californian suburb of Monterey Park are still reeling from a shooting at a dance studio last month that left 11 people dead. The attack was one of California's deadliest mass shootings and happened shortly after thousands of people had gathered for a Lunar New Year festival. Monterey Park is home to a large Asian population, many of whom are big fans of ballroom dancing. So has this tragic incident put them off? Ben DiRico visited a studio in the San Francisco Bay Area to find out.
On Lunar New Year's Eve, the Los Angeles suburb of Monterey Park became the site of a terrible shooting.
When officers arrived on scene, they observed numerous individuals, patrons of the location, pouring out of the location, screaming.
11 people were killed at Star Ballroom as they danced and celebrated with friends and family. For seniors in the Asian American community, ballroom dancing has become an incredibly popular hobby. And the shooting has reverberated around dance halls across the country, like Premier Ballroom near San Francisco.
This shooting in Los Angeles is not going to stop us, no. People still come.
Ruby Huang and her husband Peter have run this dance hall for almost 30 years. Its members are largely seniors from the local Asian American community.
Me and my Peter, we love to dance. So we opened this studio. I think this is very important to the community. And they like my family. And they think it's their family too.
It's also a place where dancers can take a break from the stresses of their daily lives.
Ballroom dancing make me happy. And I can see people, I talk to people, I listen to music. Maybe I have something stress. Then the music make me that 2-3 hours not thinking about that.
For Premier Ballroom members Hiroshi and Juliana Kawanami, dancing has been at the center of their marriage and the friendships they've created for 40 years.
My wife and I, we met through the dancing. That's how we started. This is our second marriage. So dancing is really bring us together.
While some dancers come just to strut their stuff, others take lessons from Ruby.
Have the right side, or the right side, or the right side.
Many here have no plans of staying away from the dance floor anytime soon, despite the tragic shooting that took place in Monterey Park.
I think they still want us to continue for, you know, to enjoy our dancing, because all those people there, they love dancing, you know, just like us here.
As for Ruby, she's not scared either.
Oh, I'm not afraid at all. I will be the one at the front desk to take everybody.
That report by Ben DiRico. Europe's biggest astronomy festival has just ended in London, and one of the major topics was how crowded the night sky is becoming. The UN says that last year a record 2,323 objects were launched into space. So far this year, the figure has reached 182, including 53 Starlink satellites launched by Elon Musk's SpaceX on Thursday. Astronomer Lucy Green is co-host of the Astrofest conference and a space science research fellow at UCL. Amal Rajan asked her whether she's concerned that the sky is getting too crowded.
It does concern me. There are, as you said, thousands of satellites up in this particular orbit that we call low Earth orbit. And that orbit is one in which satellites are more likely to be seen and more likely to be seen by members of the general public who would be looking up at the night sky, but also professional astronomers who'd be making observations of the night sky. And I think that the night sky is for everybody. And so we should be having a conversation about what's a sensible, appropriate and fair use of the night sky.
And just to be clear, why are more and more objects being sent into space?
I think it's a combination of things. Firstly, access to space, the cost has come down through companies like SpaceX. And there are sort of opportunities that are there to provide high speed and low latency internet connections all around the world. So using satellites in this low Earth orbit, if you have enough of them to provide the coverage that's needed, means that you can get internet access to people in hard to reach places. I mean, there are other ways to get internet access, but this is one of them. And I think this is a model that companies have tried in the past and it hasn't been financially profitable. But now the sort of access to space has changed and companies have found a way to make this model work.
One of our kind listeners, Graham Patrick, emailed us about these issues, Lucy, and he said, there is no international control on how many satellites can be sent up. Surely this is going to cause problems for telescopes. What about our rights? Are we going to look up and see hundreds of bright dots at certain times? With so many, there must be collisions. What happens to the debris? Are we going to look up and see hundreds of bright dots?
There are certain times when you see the satellites go over. So, yeah. For example, shortly after launch, before the altitude's been raised. But if you're out there as an astronomer and you're spending hours watching the night sky, then you will see some at some times crisscrossing your field of view. If there's good communications with the satellite companies, then we can know where they are and we can observe other places at those times. Or there are ways of taking the bright spots and streaks of light out of your data. But a point will be reached where we don't want to be seeing thousands crisscrossing the night sky, that we do want to be able to go out and connect to the night sky as previous civilizations did indeed, and enjoy the natural benefits of having, you know, a fantastic view of a clear night sky.
Of course. I mean, some people listening to this who aren't very good astronomers, but who are bewitched by the celestial grace of the sky at night, they might think it's quite a big place up there. Can it really be overcrowded?
Yeah, it can be. There are certain altitudes that the satellites will be in orbit at. And yeah, most of the time they are spread out, but these lower altitudes are becoming more crowded. Collision avoidance manoeuvres, that's not uncommon anymore. Earlier years in space science research, it was quite a shocking thing to hear if our satellites were coming close to each other. There was one collision several years ago now that put a lot of debris into an orbit that one of our satellites operates right. in them. And now we have to monitor that space at certain times to make sure the risk of the collision with debris is limited. But you know, we're hearing more and more now about possible collisions. And what happens when these satellites are no longer able to be operated or controlled or brought down?
Yeah, as consequences for all of us.
Yeah.
Professor Lucy Green talking to Amal Rajan. Now, do you like your Carmen in French and your Tosca in Italian? Well, the question of whether opera should be translated from its original language divides opinion. This month, the English National Opera is staging the Rheingold with a new English translation of Wagner's German text. It's the first part of the Ring cycle. Wagner specialist Professor John Dethridge talked us through this new translation.
It was necessary to do a new translation because the old ones are either too bland or there are too many mistakes in them. Also, in the past 50 years, we've moved on in Wagner research. I've been personally involved in a big project in Germany. We've gone through all the Ring sources. We've done a new edition of The Ring and also investigated the text. And I personally feel that an English translation, particularly of this work, which is about really appalling things that happen in human history, it's a little bit like Greek tragedy, and Wagner wanted it that way. He said, I'm not actually writing an opera. What it shouldn't sound like is Sunday in the Park with George. It needs to have very strong words, a logic and a clarity which the other translations don't have. And what is very interesting about this is that Wagner actually started with the libretto. He wrote the text of Rheingold. He couldn't actually start the composition of it, but he did read the text to everybody, including, I think, his pet parrot, anybody who happened to be there. translating opera is divisive because there's a lot of snobbery about it. You know, it has to be the original language. But I think the important thing is if it's to be made accessible to the audience, and Wagner said this himself, opera has to be in the language of the audience. My view is that surtitles don't actually do the job. To read a sentence above the stage is not the same thing as hearing the sentence in the context being spoken by the people on the stage. And Wagner wanted The Ring to be translated. He wanted communication. He wanted his works to be performed in front of people so that their meaning through the music and the text became very clear. And he used to say, "I don't have any works unless they are performed." I think what my translation brings to the opera is a new kind of clarity. A lot of people don't like the way I've done it because it's too brutal and some say prosaic, but then the original German is not exactly a tea party. It's actually a brutal piece. It's also a hugely heartbreaking piece. It's also an inspiring piece. What I love about Wagner is its power, hugely strong music. The texts are absolutely brilliant. And that's why Wagner is still with us. It's the aesthetic strength and presence and the controversy in these pieces. They are full of things that are still relevant today, including our very survival.
Professor John Dethridge. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back this time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Matt Cadman and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.